Once more into the breach, dear friends. He'll fill up the wall with our English dad. And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and McClure. Our Jake is out of the loop this week, and I'm in the loop, which means I am playing the role of the Lone Ranger. And I don't even have a Tonto. Did you know what the meaning of Tonto is in Spanish? You don't. It means stupid. And I've heard various translations of Kemosabe, none of which are very complimentary, which indicates that somebody had a great sense of humor and the actors had no clue how to speak Spanish. Anyway, this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and we come on every week. And today is the last broadcast of the Personal Wealth Coach live and in living color since for 2019. And if today is the 28th of December 2019, you're certainly welcome to give us a call in here at 254-773-1400. And we do seem to be having a call come in. Let me give you a couple of disclosures and disclaimers first. First, the Personal Wealth Coach is not only the name of this radio program. It's also the name of an investment advisory firm registered with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission, who neither approve nor disapprove of what we're doing. That's just who our regulator is, in Salado, Texas. Secondly, we do not pay for this program, but on the other hand, KTM does not pay us to do the program. So that makes us a little different. We do pay for advertising on this radio station, which is for the program, which is kind of a weird roll around to the other direction. Obviously, we like having our voices being heard around the wherever people are listening. You can find this radio program on either KTEM, obviously live. You can go to our website, thepersonalwealthcoach.com, and you can listen to podcasts there. You can listen to it live on www.ktemnews.com. Information we present on this program has been obtained from sources we believe to be reliable, things like the Wall Street Journal, Financial Times of London, The Economist, and so on, and the United States government, but we don't warranty or guarantee any of it to be complete or completely accurate, because things change from time to time. And I think I pretty much got him out of the way. We do have a caller on 773-1400, so Raymond, you're on the air with the Burson Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I was wanting to ask you, this concerns gold, okay? You know, you probably see these advertisements, you know, Mike's Gold Buyers, okay? You got all kinds of scraps, gold jewelry, you know, of different dimensions, 10 karat, 14, whatever, diamond. And you take it to that place and you sell it to them people. And my question is, what do they do with this gold? They just refine it and just put it back in circulation. And another thing I wanted to ask you concerning gold, when you have gold bars and you have scrap gold, what's the difference between those two type of golds? And I just wanted to correct you, sir, because I speak real fluent in Spanish. Tonto is basically somebody's name. Tonto would be stupid in the slang part of it, but if you want to pronounce it to say stupid correctly, it would say pendejo would be the correct word. So I just thought I'd let you know.
All right, thank you very much.
Good day, sir.
I appreciate your correction on Tonto. You wouldn't know what Kemosabe meant, though. There's a lot of debate over that, but
there's at least rumors going about, or went about for years, and I don't know if there's any truth to it or not, that the people who put that name in there were fully aware of the fact that it meant stupid. You know, it's all how it's pronounced, and it's all how the Lone Ranger was pronouncing it. But it was an unusual type of thing that at the time was probably a hidden joke. Anyway, and thank you for calling. The question about gold, when you sell gold to a gold dealer, they make an attempt to determine the probable resale value of what you've given them. If it's jewelry, in some cases, the jewelry will sell for more than the underlying value of the gold that's in it. In those circumstances, they'll sell it for that. In other circumstances, they realize that the jewelry is damaged or is just not likely to sell for a lot of money, and it's literally melted down as scrap, and sold for the gold content. And that is the art of being a gold buyer, is to recognize that value and to be able to resell it at a higher value. Gold bars and gold scrap, what's the difference? Well, gold scrap is of questionable quality. In other words, we don't know how much real gold is in gold scrap. Nobody does. Nobody knows whether it's been cut with something else or whether it's because gold can be mixed with other metals. Gold bars that have not been tampered with and have seals on them, particularly if the gold bar is sealed itself, have a higher value, generally speaking, than gold scrap, because the seal, the stamp on the gold bar will determine the value associated with that bar. Now, that's not to say that that's 100% true. One of the things that gold dealers have to deal with and sometimes lose money on and try not to, is the fact that a gold bar can be counterfeited. And it can be counterfeited in such a way that the, for instance, tungsten has approximately the same gravity, specific gravity as gold. So that if you have a tungsten bar buried inside a gold bar, it is very difficult to determine the difference. Now, there's ways of doing it. And as a result, gold dealers, when they buy bars, sometimes have to protect themselves against that. They either have insurance on it, or in some cases, they delay paying you the full amount until they are sure they've got the capability of determining whether tungsten has been buried inside the gold. There have been several instances throughout history, recent history, where, for example, countries in, the only ones I've known of specifically are in Africa, but I'm certainly sure it's happened in other cases too, where large quantities of gold bars were purchased, and years later when the country went to sell those gold bars, the people buying the gold bars determined that they really weren't gold bars. They were just part, half gold bar, half tungsten bar. And it was kind of embarrassing and caused a lot of people a lot of grief, and there probably was some illicit money changing hands somewhere in there. Gold is an interesting subject, to say the least. It varies in popularity. It has tremendous variance in its value. Interestingly enough, had you bought gold in 2011, you'd still be trying to make your money back, and I mean a lot. You'd be trying really, really hard and unsuccessfully to make your gold card, your money back. And after inflation, had you bought money gold in 1980, you would be no place close to having your money back. Gold is a subject we could discuss for a long period of time, but it is an uncertain investment, and there is no underlying reality to its value when compared to other investments. So that's. But we have a caller on 773-1400. John, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Enjoy the show. We've all been reading for decades about Chinese economies booming, et cetera, et cetera. There was an article in the Wall Street about debt plagues Chinese local governments. I know that the Chinese federal government owns a lot of the manufacturing companies. How much of the real estate market, and I guess there's millions of square foot of commercial and residential buildings that have been built and unoccupied, how much of that is owned by the federal government or whatever they call it? But I'll hang up on this. Thank you.
Thank you for the call, and thank you for the question, John. That's a good question, and I don't think anybody really knows the answer. There are estimates of anywhere from 40% to more of commercial real estate in China owned by the central government. And the reason we don't know is there are guesstimates, and that's the best we can have, because it's the cities that were built, called ghost cities, that were built during the Great Recession, for example, and built during the recession we had in the early 2000s, when China didn't, in neither case did China experience a recession. And the reason they didn't experience a recession is the central government let out these huge contracts to employ, and I know this sounds a little absurd, literally millions of people to build these cities that nobody lives in.
And why did they do that? For the same reason that politicians build highways that don't necessarily go anywhere sometimes. To stimulate the economy. To keep people from being out of work. And nobody knows exactly how big these are. I'm fortunate to have had a daughter who was given a tour of one of those cities because the person that who was giving her the tour was the offspring of a senior general in People's Revolutionary Army, and she had the right to take foreigners and anybody else into these areas. And it was a huge metropolis the size of a major city in the United States, and literally nobody lived in it. There were signs where a building was supposed to be a McDonald's, and there were signs. There was a sign up this building, and of course it had to be translated. This building will be a McDonald's. This building over here will be a something. This building will be a something else. But it is very, very dangerous for Westerners to go into that area because that is considered to be state secrets. And if you went in there and you didn't have a personal friend who was very, very well connected in China, you probably would never leave China with that information. Reporters have been barred from those areas from the time the buildings were built. It's hard to determine how much of the Chinese economy is owned by the state, but it's a lot. And the most reliable estimates I've seen recently indicate something like 40% of the economy is effectively owned by the government. You could say, by the way, you could make a similar argument. It isn't 40%, but you could make a similar argument in the United States. For example, here in Central Texas, we have a lot of things going on in a lot of industries and a lot of businesses, but the central driving force in Bell County is the United States Army. And if you remove the United States Army from Bell County, we would immediately go into the equivalent of a depression here, which we wouldn't recover from until the Army came back or until something very, very different happened, because particularly West Bell County would sink into a really big hurt. If the Army were suddenly removed from there, we removed most of the active duty troops from Fort Hood in 1991, and it actually created a recession in West Bell County that was pretty significant. But we still had probably half the number of troops left on Fort Hood at that point that we'd had before, and it still created a real serious problem in the economy. So you could argue that Bell County's economy is a direct result of the federal government. You could argue that probably one of the biggest manufacturers in the United States is Boeing. You could argue that Boeing would not be able to stay in business if it lost its defense contracts, and therefore Boeing is supported by the United States government. You could make these arguments, and by the way, the Chinese do, so that we have large portions of the United States that are owned by the Bureau of Land Management, that are owned by the national parks or national forests. These are owned by the federal government. So if you went and looked at all the private property that's owned in the United States by the federal government, it's a significant percentage of the country. It's not like 40%. So there's an argument that goes both ways. China definitely has a lot of major industry that is primarily owned or solely owned by the government of China. And they have an argument for doing that. And that's one of the conflicts between the United States and China right now over economies. China has a great fear of chaos. To give me some idea why China owns so much of its own industry from their perspective, there is a population of 360, roughly, nobody knows this number exactly, but it's an estimate, 360 million people in China that are migrant workers. They move from place to place to place whenever the harvests are due, whenever something else is due. They have no social benefits. They have no social security. They have no health care provided for them. They just move around from job to job to job, but they move in mass. If the Chinese economy were disrupted to the point where that group of migrant of workers showed up someplace and they didn't have work to do, there would be 360 million angry, out of work, hungry people, which would not be good for the stability or the continued existence of the People's Republic of China. The same thing is true in the industries where the Chinese continue to own huge factories and steel mills and own big portions of major corporations. You don't hear reports, because it doesn't happen, of major layoffs in China. It just doesn't happen. You don't see major employers going out of business. It just isn't going to happen in China. And the reason is the Chinese are very, very sensitive to the fact that they have a top-down, relatively inefficient government. They have a lot of social stresses in China as a result of being a developing economy. And the end result is that they don't want to have large numbers of people out of work, because that large number of people out of work might turn revolutionary. The Chinese have a deep, deep, deep ingrained fear of chaos. We don't have that fear. We have stable institutions in the United States. We have a free enterprise system that, at least since the Great Depression, has worked very, very well. Although, again, if you want an interesting perspective on this, the way we got out of the Great Depression, and it's generally accepted among economists, is World War II. The federal government basically hired all the out-of-work people and some people who were working at less than desirable jobs, so that we basically bailed ourselves out of the Great Depression by the federal government spending a truly astonishing amount of money and going deeper in debt as a percentage of gross domestic product than we've ever been since, to fight a major war. And that hasn't been ignored since then. Our lowest unemployment rate is not where we are now. We're really very close to the lowest unemployment rate we've ever had. But the lowest unemployment rate was at the height of the Vietnam War, when we had literally millions of people employed by the armed forces to fight the war in Vietnam, which effectively put an end to a recession. We had a recession as we started to leave Vietnam, and the armed forces started to lay people off, started to release soldiers into the economy. 1973, we had a recession. And it's no coincidence that that recession occurred just as we were dumping, the army particularly, was dumping millions of people back into the economy. And so we had way more people than we had jobs. And the personal income dropped like a rock. That's probably the best explanation for the 1973 recession that we had. China is still far more statist than we are today. But here's the irony. The federal government during the 1940s had a bigger piece, owned a bigger piece of the United States economy, either directly or indirectly, than the Chinese own today. So it's one of those things where we point our finger at the Chinese and say they shouldn't be doing that. But at the same time, we look back in our history and we see where we did it when we thought it was necessary. There's arguments to be made both ways. The Chinese have a different approach to just about everything. And by the way, I don't consider the Chinese the high-level threat that probably some other people do, because very frankly, the Chinese have no capability and no desire to go around conquering nations around them. They have definitely, during the pure communist Maoist period, absorbed nations like Tibet because they were traditionally part of China. They don't allow full democracy. They allow a form of democracy that's very, very, very limited. They definitely persecute any form of what we call freedom of expression, and the fact that they haven't cracked down on Hong Kong right now shows amazing restraint based on their history. But the Chinese have no intrinsic desire to conquer the world. They have no intrinsic desire, for instance, to occupy their neighbor like Vietnam or India. And what they do have is a sincere desire to rise up to be equal to the United States as far as economic power is concerned, as far as technological power is concerned. The rising to the military power of the United States is probably unlikely. If China had 60 years and they devoted themselves wholeheartedly and with a much larger portion of their economy devoted to armed forces than they have today, they might be able to come up to equal where the United States is today as far as their ability to project their power around the world. The problem with that is, and this is something else that the Chinese fundamentally have, they're very much aware of, and they're very much concerned about, and that is their demographics won't support it. 60 years from now, China will be in decline in many ways. Just like Japan a few decades ago at the end of the 20th century, Japan was a serious world threat from our perspective. They were doing things like buying Madison Square Garden. They bought it. They bought the major golf courses in the United States. The Chinese, matter of fact, if you watched Back to the Future, the assumption was that the Japanese would dominate the world by this point in history. By the time we got well into the 21st century, the Japanese would be the dominant power in the whole world, and everybody in the United States would be working for a Japanese company. And of course, it didn't happen. Why didn't it happen? Because despite the fact that Japan was surging ahead technologically and in many, many, many ways, their demographics couldn't support them. Their population is currently shrinking. It's aging rapidly. And they ran up a lot of debt in the process of expanding. And they bought Pebble Beach. They bought the golf course. They bought Madison Square Garden. They bought a lot of signature properties in the United States. And then later, 10 years or so later, sold them at considerably less than they paid for them. And they have never really firmly dealt with that. Their current, the Japanese national debt, the debt owed by their central government, is 250% of their GDP. Ours is about 74% of our GDP, to give you a perspective on that. And they're struggling and have been for more than a decade with a permanent deflation, and actions by the government keep the economy from sinking and the situation from decaying further. And there's lots in Japanese have lots of highways that go nowhere. I shouldn't say go nowhere. They have lots of super highways with very little traffic on it. They have an abundance of high-speed bullet trains that don't carry very many people. They have spent a tremendous amount of money on public works to keep people employed, because that's part of their culture to do that. And there's a lot of lessons to be learned from there. One of which is probably not a good one, which is that the modern monetary theory, it's called, says you can borrow as much money as you want to see it work for the Japanese. That's a bad approach, by the way. And the reason it's a bad approach is a big chunk of the Japanese economy is dependent upon the United States dollar being stable. Suffice to say, that's true all the way around the world. For that matter, the Chinese economy is dependent upon the stability of the United States dollar. People are always afraid, since the Chinese own of all foreign holders, they are probably the largest holder of U.S. debt. They don't hold a great significant part of it. The vast majority of U.S. debt is held by the United States, by people in the United States and organizations in the United States. But the Chinese would be literally shooting themselves not in the foot but in the head if they were to destabilize the dollar, because they use dollars to purchase overseas raw materials that they import into Japan to keep their economy going. And if the value of the dollar were to fall dramatically, it would cause tremendous instability in Japan, and their holdings would deteriorate rapidly. And the reason the Chinese currency has any value internationally at all, which they allow very limited amounts of it to leave the country, but still the fact that there is a conversion factor that's generally accepted for the Chinese currency is because the Chinese currency is backed by U.S. Treasury debt and dollars that they've gotten through their trade surplus with us. Their ability for their economy to continue to function is dependent upon their ability to pay with dollars for iron ore and the other things they need to import. The oil, they buy oil with dollars. They did some experimentation and have on several occasions of using the euro, but the euro is fundamentally unstable. The euro does not have a single nation or a single government that backs it. It is a coalition of a bunch of countries that make up the eurozone, any one of which can veto anything. And that's a fundamentally unstable situation. The euro has done poorly against the dollar as far as valuation is concerned because it is unstable. And the Europeans are having a heck of a time digging themselves out of the last recession. Matter of fact, they haven't completely recovered from it, and they're going back into central bank stimulus to keep from sliding back into recession. There's nothing else in the world besides the dollar that stabilizes world exchanges. And that is it. It's the world reserve currency. Interestingly enough, the majority of currency, dollars, 77% of the actual currency in circulation is $100 bills, and something like 90% of that is held outside the United States as reserves that people have that are in particularly more wealthy people in places like Russia and China and other nations around the world hold, they have safes with stacks of $100 bills in them. This is their emergency reserve in case their local currency collapses, and that also occurs across Europe. There's a lot of realities in the big wide world that are hard for us to grasp, one of which is just exactly how big and powerful we are, and the other one is how much a lot of people resent it. But still, they are dependent upon us to survive, for stability. And it is a good thing, I think. The last time we had a leaderless world was as Great Britain was declining and its empire was basically backing out of its empire slowly, was before World War II. And the British were unwilling to guarantee the stability of Europe. They decided that they needed to, following the Depression, they needed to basically pull in and make Britain great again. They got governments that did not want to get involved in foreign wars and did not want to get involved in stabilizing the rest of Europe. And the Germans rose up to take their place, and they did so by invading other countries. Very frankly, if the United States were to back out of stabilizing the world at this point, boy, I'm wandering way off subject here, but if the United States were to back out of being willing to stabilize the world at this point, there's no question that Russia would begin to absorb the nations around it. There's some very good reasons that they would want to absorb the nations around them. They traditionally have wanted a buffer between them and the West. Why do they want a buffer between them and the West? Because they have been invaded so many times from the West until recently, they were invaded once per generation with alarming regularity from the West. The Germans particularly would invade them once per generation. And they have a deep-seated memory of the fact that they don't have any natural barriers between them and Western Europe. And they would love to get Germany dependent upon them where Germany's threat is eliminated. And they could manipulate the politics and the activities in Germany, which is, by the way, why, to bring it right down to the recent events, the Nord Sea pipeline that runs directly from Russia into Germany to deliver natural gas so the Germans can have cheap natural gas to keep themselves warm in the wintertime, was effectively interdicted by the Trump administration in the last few weeks. The Trump administration put sanctions on any company that is involved in building that pipeline, and there's only 164 kilometers of it left to be built under the North Sea. And the Swiss company that was doing it immediately stopped building the pipeline. The Germans are, by the way, infuriated at this point with us and are trying to form a coalition of Europeans to separate themselves from the United States, from dependency upon the United States, and insulate themselves from sanctions and tariffs from the United States by setting up, by setting up economic entities to handle that in Russia and China. This will be one of those things to watch. It's a turning point in history. The reason we interdicted the North Sea pipeline economically was because we don't want Germany to become dependent upon Russia and thereby subject to strong Russian influence. The Germans, on the other hand, are very interested in getting the inexpensive natural gas that would come through that pipeline to heat their houses in the wintertime and run their industry, because they don't have a reliable source of natural gas and they are trying to reduce their carbon emissions, so they don't want to use oil or coal. And it's a very complex thing. By the way, the Russians have countered that. That's part of the news I was going to talk about this week. They are bringing a pipeline-laying ship that was in Southeast Asia back around in the spring. It will go into the North Sea and finish laying that pipeline, and then it'll be complete. But there's been a pretty severe policy rupture between Germany, which has been our ally since the end of World War II, until the present, and they consider this to be almost an act of war by the United States to cut off their access to inexpensive and natural gas that would help their economy continue to grow. This will be one of those things that will go down in the history books, conceivably, possibly, as a major turning point in history. Germany, in effect, is rotating towards Russia and China and away from the United States because they consider our government to be unstable and interfering in their internal affairs excessively. This has been gradually building for some time, but it's getting pretty significant at this point. It's one of those things that if you're noting things down in history, that this probably will have a major effect some point in the future. This is one of those things. This probably will have a major effect at some point in the future. And it is something worth watching. You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. Telephone number in here is 254-773-1400. This is Jeff McClure, and I'm here alone without Jake today, trying to make my head spin in the correct direction. And we do have to do some commercials, though. So we'll probably take a break for commercials. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach.
The following is made possible by Dad.
Why was the basketball court all wet? Because the players kept dribbling all over it.
The dad joke. Corny, groan-worthy, but also one of the simplest ways to share a moment with your kids.
Why do you have to be careful when it's raining cats and dogs? Because you might step in a poodle.
And kids that spend more time with their dads grow up to be smarter, more successful.
Can I tell you a cat joke? Just kidding.
And with any luck, funnier adults.
Why didn't the skeleton go to the dance? Because he didn't have any body to go with.
Dad jokes rule. So take a moment to make a moment and give your kid a laugh. It's as easy as going to fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
That's really funny.
1 in 3 adults in America have prediabetes, but most don't know it. To let people know it can be reversed before it becomes type 2 diabetes, professional basketball player Julius Randle is doing everything in reverse.
I'm only dunking with reverse windmills. I drove the whole way to practice in reverse. I don't recommend it. This move is called the reverse shuffle. I do recommend it. And it took me months to learn how to speak in reverse, like this. Here's 10 almost for diabetes type 2 with living Ben has mom my. In other words, my mom has been living with type 2 diabetes for almost 10 years. So together, we want to say to the 84 million Americans at risk, exercise and healthy eating can help reverse prediabetes. Start by taking a simple one-minute risk test at doihaveprediabetes.org.
Brought to you by the Ad Council and its prediabetes awareness partners.
Bet he can't say that in reverse.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff McClure. Jake is out today. taking the day off and trying to relax and rest a little bit in this hectic Christmas, New Year's holiday season. Let's talk about the markets just a little bit. About, the telephone number in here, presuming that today is December 28th, 2019, is 254-773-1400. You're certainly welcome to give us a call or give me a call. Well, actually, there's an us in here because we have an engineer. Ask a question, make a comment, stimulate something for me to do with my brain. And that worked really well. We got a telephone call. So, caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
I just like to know, when charities advertise for money, donation, why is it always $19? I'll listen. Bye.
All right.
Well, it isn't always $19. Of course, I don't watch television, regular broadcast television, so I'm not familiar with what comes on there. But we do contribute to my family and our business does contribute to charities, and the ones that we contribute to don't ask for $19. But there's a reason. For instance, if you see something advertised, a lot of times it'll be $29.95 or $29.99. Because our brains immediately react to that to say that's about $20, despite the fact it is really about $30. We tend to round to whatever the first figure is in the number. And the result is that it feels like you're contributing less. For instance, if you ask people to contribute $20 or to contribute $29, if you ask people to contribute $10 or $19, they don't feel a great deal of difference between the two, but between 10 and 20, they feel a big difference. So $19.99 or $19 or $29 sounds like a lower amount of money, and people will jump on and do it more readily. That's really it in a nutshell. John Cash Penny is famous for originating that process of putting prices on things that are one or two pennies below the round figure. It was 99 cents or $1.99. Of course, in those days, it bought a lot more than it does today. So that's the answer to your question. To the best of my knowledge, at any rate. Let's talk about the markets for a minute. The stock market, measured by the Dow Jones Industrial Average or the S&P 500, and we follow the S&P 500 because we think it's a little more representative, has been doing daily records. I mean, it is almost every day in the last several weeks. The stock market indices have broken an all-time record. But despite that, over the last week, even though it had a record close literally every day the New York Stock Exchange was open for the last week, the S&P 500 was only up 0.58%. And I say only 0.58%, but if you took even half a percent and you multiply it times 52 weeks, you get a 25% gain. Well, considering that is pretty much what has happened, the S&P 500 is up about 28%, or I don't have the exact figures in front of me, but it's up just under 30% for the year to date. Of course, it was down 25%. It was down 20% right at the end of last year, so that's a little bit non-representative. But we've had an amazing bull run in the market this year. The S&P 500 closed at 3240.02. And if you recall, last summer, it was at 2929, and I pointed that out. It is come a long way since then. The index is up 3.15% for the last month and 9.39% for the trailing 3 months. So in the last 3 months, the S&P 500 has risen considerably more than its historic average for a year. And that indicates we are definitely in a bull market. Now, this is an interesting point. The word on the street, as reported by traders and investors, is the reason the market is going up is investors expect significant increases in profits in 2020. I have a lot of trouble seeing where that's coming from. They expect that there will be dramatic increases, improvements in the tariff wars. There's a signing coming up theoretically, although we've had promised signings before, of a phased one deal where the United States officially renounces the December 15th tariffs that we didn't put into place, and we reduce tariffs by half on $120 million worth of imports. The Chinese then promise to buy a truly massive quantity of agricultural production in the United States. There's some questions about some of that. For example, the amount that the reports that we have so far of the Chinese, the agricultural goods that the Chinese will buy per year exceed the production capacity that we have left over after fulfilling other contracts and domestic contracts. In other words, if in fact they did buy that quantity of agricultural production in the United States, it probably would raise the cost of food in the United States pretty significantly. So whether that will actually work out or not is questionable. But that is questionable. But here's the point. The stock market is beyond its normal upper limit at this point. We're having the current price-to-earnings ratio, and not future, but current, is around 25. It's actually 24.73, I think, at this point. But it is definitely way above its long-term mean or average of 15.77. It's not wildly out of bounds. It's 24.27. That's what it is. 25 PE is the normal trigger that within a year you have a major market correction or a bear market. Sometimes, in a couple of occasions, we've gone longer than a year, but it generally means we're closer to having a market correction, a major market correction, than we are to having to not. And we're closing in on the 25 point. If we continue this run of record-breaking levels in the S&P 500, we probably will have a significant correction or a bear market in 2020. There's no certainty of anything that we can predict there. But it fits the pattern of history. It is certainly a lot of indicators are pointing in that direction. Yes, the consumer is doing very, very well, but very little else in the economy is. And that is another indicator that we are closer to a downturn than we are to a greater growth in the economy. And I realize that Jake and I are almost the lone voices saying this right now, because there's all this good news out there. New house sales are up dramatically in November. There's a lot of pluses out there in the economy, but the longer-term indicators, manufacturing is probably the lead indicator that has got us very concerned. Strongly indicate that there's something wrong. There's several other aspects about the economy that are doing the same thing. Another measure of the real level of the stock market is to look at the yield on the 10-year treasury versus the yield of the stock market. When the stock market's yield is higher than that of the 10-year treasury, meaning the dividends on the S&P 500, then the stock market is undervalued. It means, hey, we should, it's probably a good idea to be if you're into surging in and out of the stock market, stocks are a bargain, it's a good time to buy. When the yield on the stock market is below that of the 10-year treasury, it's an indicator that we have a bump coming, that the stock market will probably correct within the next year. Now, this is not a certainty, again. This is just a probability. And the yield on the 10-year treasury note is 1.878, whereas the dividend yield on the S&P 500 is now 1.44%. Now, there's a little bit of fudge factor in there, because stock buybacks are not included in the dividend yield and probably should be, and that would run it up to about 1.5 or 1.6%, the yield on the S&P 500. But it's still below that of the 10-year treasury note, which indicates, again, that the stock market is a little overpriced at this point. We're overdue for a correction. Now, whether the correction turns into a full-blown bear market is always a question, but you really should be prepared. Market timing isn't going to work. The reason I say market timing isn't going to work, in other words, getting out of the market in anticipation of a recession or a downturn, doesn't work. And the reason I say it doesn't work is nobody has ever been able to execute it over the long term without losing their shirt. And when I say nobody, I mean nobody, has been able to do something in history with tremendous resources applied to it, the chances of any individual beating that system are nil. And that's just the reality of what's going on. As I said, the 10-year Treasury is paying 1.878, which is certainly much higher than it was in the recent past. However, it is still down a full percentage point from where it was last year at this time, and which indicates that the bond market is anticipating lower economic growth in the next 1 to 2 years at least. The yield curve is pretty healthy looking except for the near term. In other words, the very short-term interest rates are higher than the intermediate-term interest rates. But once you get out to 10 years, they're higher than short-term rates, which indicates long-term, the economy is probably in pretty good shape. But in the intermediate term, 1 to 2 years, we're probably going to hit a bump. It's been saying that for all year, literally. The oil actually rose a little bit. It's up at 61.72. It's up 0.7% for the week. That's West Texas Intermediate Oil. And why do we track that? Because it is an indicator of what's going on in the global economy. If demand for oil is rising, then the price will tend to go up. And if the price goes up, that's an indication that we probably do, at least in the short term, for some pretty good economic news. There's a peculiarity goes on in the economy at this point. It's been going on for some time, and economists have written a lot about it, but it's generally very poorly understood. Unemployment in the United States is the lowest it has ever been. You go back to the late 1960s and early 1970s, and unemployment was this low for a short period of time, but it's never been lower than we currently have it. Wages, though, historically, when we have super low unemployment, have risen and started rising dramatically and then doubled down on rising some more because the competition between employers for employees caused them to bid up the wages they're willing to pay. And economists have been waiting for that to happen for several years now, and it just hasn't happened. But we may be beginning to see it. About 80%, 82% of workers are in the lower 25% of pay in the United States. That group of hourly, the bottom 25% for pay in the United States, that group has seen a year over year as of November, a 4.5% growth in wages. That is quite significant. It is obviously much higher than inflation, and it is higher than the upper 25% is getting. The upper 25% is only up about 1.9%. The middle is up about 2 points, right around 2%. But the lowest quartile, as far as wages are concerned, which is 82% of workers, have seen their wages rise 4.5% in the last year. And they were stuck in a flat position before that. So we're starting to see things normalize a little bit. We're starting to see the labor demand show up as higher prices for labor. Now, why do I think that's important? Because earnings for corporations have been declining for the last several months. Matter of fact, the last quarter, we've seen a significant decline, the last two quarters, in corporate margins and earnings profits. And the stock market is currently running up on expectations of higher profits next year. I don't know, frankly, where they're getting that. I think it's just emotional surging into the market. It's speculation. It's not irrational yet, although it's verging on the edge of irrational exuberance. What we've seen is the cash flows reversing. All year, as the market has run up until this last couple of months, we saw people leaving equities, in the mutual funds particular, and their 401ks. They are backing out of equities and going to bonds. Bonds became massively overpriced. And now we see people shifting from bonds back into stocks now that the stock market is breaking records. And that's a traditional way of marking the end of a bull market, is when the Joe average investor that literally doesn't know common stock from livestock starts flooding the market with money, not because of underlying fundamentals, but because the market's going up. And currently, the similarities appear to me to be very, very obvious between 1999 and 2019. We seem to be very much in the same boat of people are investing in the market, not because it's a good place to invest your money at this point. It is a good place long term, but because it's going up. That's not to say you should bail out of the market. I'm certainly not suggesting that in any way. That, like I said, that is a losing proposition. Everybody who's ever tried it that I know of, and everybody that I've ever been able to research that did it over a long period of time, wind up doing very poorly. Matter of fact, Dalbar, who does research on investing and investor behavior, has noted that of discrete types of investors, market timers over the long term have the worst possible returns. Matter of fact, they often have negative returns in a bull market. Jumping in and out of the market, some traders do that pretty well in the short term, some don't. But one of the things that we've noticed is even though we have a bull market going on, a major bull market going on, the number of hedge funds closing, often with a loss, has been rising year over year for 2 years now. Hedge funds are the people who do the big time timing of the market, the big time jumping in and out, and the big time trying to figure out what's going to happen in the short term and take advantage of it. And they're becoming less and less and less successful. Even the major ones that are still open have had very poor results. Well, we're almost out of time for this hour, but we've got a caller on 773-1400. So, caller, if you need to be quick with whatever you're going to say, but you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach.
Yeah, you can do this after the top of the hour, but there was a thing in the Wall Street about generational favorites and investments, like millennials want to do something called Grayscale Bitcoin Trust. That's like one of their top investments. And Tesla is big for millennials. And I was just curious if previous generations had their favorites. You can do it after the
sure.
Of the hour. Thanks.
Bye. Thanks for the call.
And we are down to the last minute of the hour. And this has been the first hour of the Personal Wealth Coach. And if you'd like to contact us off the air, we do manage money for relatively well-off people, people who are financially independent. And we are a fiduciary firm registered with the SEC. And our telephone number is 254-947-1111 or 1-800-914-7526. Or you can find everything about us at thepersonalwealthcoach.com. You can listen to podcasts of this radio program and see how prophetic we were and have been in the past. Or you can give us an email either at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. And we certainly would like to have your emails, even if they are nothing more than what we should talk about during the radio program. And until next hour, we will be back, Lord willing. And this has been the Personal Wealth Coach, and I'm running about 2 seconds ahead, so we'll